हेलो गाइस, वेलकम टू अपग्रेड विद नकुल। अगर एप्पल हर 11 महीने में अपने फोन अपग्रेड कर सकता है तो हम हर हफ्ते अपग्रेड क्यों नहीं हो सकते? द पॉइंट ऑफ द शो इज वी मीट इंटरेस्टिंग पीपल, दे गिव अस देयर प्रोडक्टिविटी हैक्स, द टेक्नोलॉजी दे यूज, और हम होंगे अपग्रेड उनके साथ। Hey everybody, welcome to another exciting episode of Upgrade with Nakul. And today I have Aditya with me, and Aditya was my school junior but is a superb journalist. I don't know if you follow him on Twitter, he gives the latest news to you, and that's great. He's going to talk about all about media journalism with us, and let's see what we can learn from him. Hey Aditya, how are you?
Hey Nakul, thanks for calling me to your podcast. Very excited. I've been following your huge moves in the industry. And as you said, we've come way back from school. You've been my super senior. And what great avatars now we both are in. And exciting to, have this conversation with you.
Okay, so Aditya, we know each other now for 15 years, and we both were in bus together, and from bus to now you've become an independent journalist. Did you actually think from school that you wanted to become a journalist? How did that journey happen?
What you're asking me is a long story. It's a long journey. I don't know if people would be really keen and interested to know about this, but I wanted to be a journalist always. There's a passion that was within me. And I tell this almost always to whoever asks me this question, that as a kid in school, people dream and have aspirations of becoming either a teacher or doctor or finally joining the armed forces. Similarly, I had this dream or a passion of becoming a journalist. I used to write frequently for the school newspaper and the magazine, although I was a shy kid. And, journalists are usually not shy. And I always wanted to become a print journalist. I had no aspirations of actually joining the television. Destiny had some other plans, but I began as an activist. Not many understand this because usually journalists convert themselves into activists. I was perhaps the one odd figure who first became an activist during my student days and then turned into a journalist. So, my board examinations were still on. This is back in March 2006. And I had to give one last paper of psychology. And psychology, as I remember, during those days, is a subject that I didn't like very much. And I had about more than a week to study for the same. And I was mostly just loitering around. And, usually people amidst exams become very creative and artistic and try to do much more than they usually do. So I was just, loitering in my mother's office, which was near Cannot Place in Delhi on Janpath. And one fine day, I remember that while I was going through her computer in her office, I came across a case. And I also read in the newspaper, I think it was the Indian Express, about a case of Priyadarshini Mattu that you might have heard about, Nakul. This was a very brutal rape and murder case where Priyadarshini Mattu, who was a law student in Delhi University in the law faculty, was raped and murdered by her senior, who was at that time the son of a DGP of Goa. And this had happened in Vasant Kunj in South Delhi. And for 10 years since that day, there was no hearing happening in that case. The judge in the lower court who had heard it, I think back in 96 or 97, had said that though I know that he's the man who has committed the crime, but I give him benefit of doubt because of the lack of evidence. So the prosecution could not get enough evidence to convict or for the trial to really continue in that particular case. So I read about it. I saw an interview of, I think, Priyadarshini's father on CNN, IBN, and I was shocked. I was somehow very impatient. I really wanted to do something. But I was a 16-year-old back then. I was just, about to end my schooling, and I didn't know what to do. But as luck would have it, at that particular time, just browsing through the internet, and mind you, Nakul, those days there was no social media, there was no Facebook or Twitter, and Orkut had just about arrived. And I came across this website called petitiononline.com. And this petition, I read about it, what this really means. It means, you know, you can write whatever you want, you can address it to whoever you want, and you can collect signatures, you can spread awareness, and you can build your own campaign.
Petition.com has been very popular since, I think, 2012 now.
Yes, absolutely.
You get a petition once a week now.
Absolutely. And I mean, there are many others that have come up now. I mean, change.org is doing the same thing, like on a massive scale in India. And I have my friends who have been working for change.org in the recent times. But at that particular time in 2006, till about 2010 or 12, it wasn't really active in India. It wasn't something that, you know, Indians had really thought about. It was very much active in Europe and US, but not much in India.
Like 10 years behind.
Absolutely. So I came across this, and, you know, just as an awareness measure, or perhaps to give myself satisfaction, I wrote a few paragraphs. I addressed it to the Chief Justice of India and the President of India, asking for a retrial and a reinvestigation in the case, because it had been 10 years. The victim had died. The parents were getting old, and there was no sign of justice, no light at the end of the tunnel.
What were you expecting out of that letter? When you wrote it as a 16-year-old, first of all, what was your emotion?
Well, there were two aspects. One, as I said, I was very impatient and I wanted to do something. So it gave me some certain amount of satisfaction that perhaps at least, you know, at my individual level, I was trying to do something at least. Because I knew that, you know, I'm not a journalist. I'm not an activist. I'm not somebody who really matters in the larger scheme of things. So at least my effort of a small petition, even if I collect 100 signatures, would have mattered in my own way. And secondly, yes, I felt that technically a retrial or a reinvestigation is something that the parents really deserve at that point in time. And this really gives a very wrong signal to the common masses in India that how the judiciary or the investigative agencies are really functioning. So I went ahead with this petition. Within 24 hours or a little more, I collected 1,000 signatures, which was almost shocking for me. I mean, I had just sent that petition to about maybe 40 or 50 people, and maybe they had spread it across much more or people.
Yeah, in those times, internet was not the internet of now, right? Getting connected to 1,000 people on internet was a killer task.
Absolutely. I mean, it was unthinkable.
Yeah, I remember 2007, and that's when I passed my engineering. I had a total of 400 or 500 Orkut friends.
I hope they used to write testimonials for you. So, yeah. So, I remember within 24 hours or maybe in 48 hours, I received an email, because petitiononline.com only had a provision of giving the email of the originator of the petition, no phone numbers or other contact details. So I got an email from NDTV, from a journalist, a very famous crime journalist called Anusuya Roy. And she told me that I've been desperately trying to reach you. I don't know where you stay, but we want to do a story on you, the petition that you have started. So either you call me or we want to reach out to you or, you know, meet you. So I called her and she said, where do you stay? I said, I stay in Asian Village in South Delhi. She said, wonderful. I stay. Our office is in Greater Kailash. And we're just coming to your house. And I said, whoa, you need to stop a little, because my board examinations are on and my parents will never allow me for any kind of interview. They said, don't worry, we'll convince your parents. And my father was traveling at that time. I think he was in Rajasthan. And my mother was a little, you know, more than being furious, she was a little nervous and scared that, you know, the accused here is a powerful person. He's son of a former DGP. And anything would happen. So she almost tried to lock me in a room. And my father had to convince her that, you know, let him do this interview. And perhaps after this interview, he will continue studying for the last board exam. Anyway, so NDTV did that story. They flashed the story next day, saying that a 16-year-old Aditya Raj Kaul has started this petition. And this became a top headline because, you know, these days the TV channels are all ballistic and scream a lot. But those days, they didn't scream as much. And this was perhaps the top headline for the entire day. And in the evening, I remember, I think Nidhi Razan was the anchor of that show, X Factor. And I had Vinod Mehta, the famous editor, and the former bureaucrat Harsh Mandir with me on the debate. And that really triggered a huge following because they flashed my email again on their channel for the entire day. And I received hundreds of emails from people asking me to take this forward. And I didn't know what to do because I used to tell them that, boss, what I did was for my own satisfaction and perhaps for awareness. And I'm not a professional activist. I don't run any NGO. I'm not even a politician or even a journalist. So I don't know what to do.
Yeah, basically you would reply, hey, I'm just a kid.
Yeah, I could have. So, I mean, many people got in touch and they said, no, nothing doing. This is a great initiative, but there needs to be a next step. And I had no clue what this next step really is going to be. But there were some good Samaritans. There were some good, great people from all across the globe again. I know there was this gentleman called Vikas from US. There was a journalist called Ridhima in Delhi. There was another guy called Vivek. I remember the very importantly because these were the people who not only motivated me, but they said that we'll support you, we'll come with you, and you do whatever you want to. And, you know, we should at least organize a protest and petition wherever we can. So we decided that on the birth anniversary, I think it was in July 2006, we'll organize a huge protest at India Gate, for which we didn't at the end get permission. And finally, we organized a protest at Jantar Mantar. And to my amazement, there were thousands of people that turned up. Again, this wasn't planned.
In those times,
yeah,
there were no WhatsApp, right?
And this was the same time when the Jessica Lal campaign was also underway. And so you remember Jessica Lal campaign where there was a lot of do and try.
There were a bunch of these things in those years, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So I was part of the Jessica Lal campaign as well, but more importantly, Priyadarshini, because that's what I started independently. So there were these friends that came in. So we had many people that came in. I mean, Anupam Kher flew down from Mumbai to participate in the protest. We had Menaka Gandhi coming in. We had, at that time, Shiv Khera was very popular. So as a motivational speaker, he was there. We had many others. I mean, I don't remember many names, but many people came in. And next day, immediately after this protest, the High Court, the first time in 10 years, took a suo motu cognizance of the protest and said that we are putting this case on a daily hearing basis and there would be, you know, a daily hearing and immediately justice would be done. I remember, I think July, this case began. By October, this case had ended. A person who was out for about 10 years now was convicted to death sentence. And this was huge.
Yeah.
I mean, till that time, I was not scared because people used to tell me that, aren't you scared? You're taking on the high and mighty and powerful. But at that time, I became a little scared because I was inside the court and the friends and family members of the accused tried to heckle me and a few other journalists. And so it became a little scary aspect. But anyways, while you are at your peak as an activist, you don't remember these small incidents. So this was it. I mean, this was, I would call this as my claim to fame in a way. But this was a great satisfaction for the parents of Priyadarshini as well, who were old and frail. They didn't know what to do. They used to stay in Jammu. They used to start shuttle between Srinagar, Jammu and Delhi. And I remember very emotional meetings with them where they had tears in their eyes and they didn't know what to do. But gradually, the accused Santosh Kumar Singh reached out to the Supreme Court. And his death sentence, I think in 2011 or 10, was converted from death to life sentence. So currently he's on a life sentence. And life sentence now in India means not 14 years, but till your death. So he's still inside prison. He's been trying to come out on humanitarian grounds, but hasn't been successful till then. So that's how it began. So while I was doing this, I came in contact with several students from JNU, from Amity, from Delhi University, from IP. And we started a group called United Students, particularly in Delhi University.
Okay.
And I became part of the anti-reservation, anti-caste-based reservation movement as well. And we organized protests and press conferences, again, without much support or any planning or any financial aid. We just used to collect money ourselves and finance our own crusade. And I remember some of us just decided that, we should write to the president. And president at that time was President Kalam. And we said we should just write to him and said that, boss, I mean, this is not done and there should be at least affirmative action and everybody should get an equal opportunity. And one fine day, I got a call from, I just got a call on my landline. And they said, we're calling from Rashtrapati Bhavan and the president would like to meet you.
Wow.
And this was, I think, May in 2006. And I was like, wow. It took a little time to process.
I won't believe it.
For a minute, it took a couple of minutes for me to digest this because they immediately asked, so can you give us the card number and how many people will come? And I was like, can you give me a few minutes to get back to you? So I had to discuss this with my team and, you know, five of us went finally. And President met us for a good 1 hour. We had a good discussion. And I was the youngest among them. I was 17 at that point in time. And I remember coming out of the Rashtrapati Bhavan at the forecourt. And there was huge media presence because reservation in 2006 had become a boiling issue.
Well, but what was the discussion with the president?
It was a very interesting discussion where we did less talking and he did most talking. And as an educator, as a teacher, as a wonderful personality, he told us that, you know, you should focus on your studies. Don't worry much about this. This will be taken care of. And particularly to me, because he said, how old are you? I said, I'm 17. He said, so where do you study? I said, I just passed out of school. I'm about to join Delhi University. And he said, boss, this doesn't even, you know, concern you so much. Why are you so worried? You should focus on your studies. So I said, sir, I'm focusing on my studies, but I think I should be doing much more for the society. And this is a just cause. So I think he was very patient. He was very empathetic.
Yeah, I love that guy. I thought that was the only kind of the right appointment we Indians did.
They did a very long time. Yeah, I agree.
And till time to come. Yeah, till before him and after him, president has just become
a symbolic feature. Yeah.
Yeah, it has no value. And when he was the president, everybody was like, oh.
He was the people's president. People loved him. He wasn't really elected from voting, but I'm sure if they would have been voting, he would have won from a landslide. So yes, he had this deep charisma. Also, another thing, Nakul, I don't know if you would know this, because you used to come to Asian Village very frequently in the bus. Kalam used to stay in Asian Village.
Oh, I had no clue.
So he used to stay in Asian Village for many, many years. So remember, before becoming the president, he was in the DRDO. And in DRDO, he had a guest house accommodation there. And in that guest house, he used to, almost for 2 decades, he used to stay there. So I had met him on the eve of him becoming the president. I remember I was in school. I think it was 2001, if I'm not wrong. And I took Abhinav with me. And there was this another girl, Anu. And he was very encouraging. And, you know, this was just on the eve and he was so busy with all the protocol officers, etc. Has to be done tomorrow at Rashtrapati Bhavan. But he gave us time. So that was a brief meeting with him. So these two campaigns really became, you know, kickstart a moment for me. But at the back of my mind, I knew that journalism was my calling and this really isn't really going to help me much in my journalistic career. So that's how it began.
No, so did you think that journalism will help you become a stronger activist? Is that the goal?
I don't think so. How should I explain? My life in a way has had an impact on my thinking and my approach and how I have perceived things. So my background, if I can briefly tell you, is from Kashmir. I was born in Kashmir in 1989, but due to terrorism and violence, we had to move out. So my family and my community, and we had to stay in a temporary accommodation, a refugee camp for a few months, and which was almost like a garage accommodation in Jammu, in sweltering heat. And then gradually we moved to Delhi. My parents, had to start life from scratch. So I have seen their hardships. I've seen how they basically, did everything possible that I wasn't uncomfortable, that I didn't feel the pain of exile. I remember first, I don't remember, I'm told, because I was very young at that time. That first time when we came to Delhi for the first 6 months in East Delhi, we used to stay in a room which had no windows. So I kind of have had these things at the back of my mind. So this perhaps also led to my initial years in activism, that I had this rage or fire or anger within me, which I wanted to channelize in some way. And particularly about the Priyadarshini Mantu case, in the year 2003, early 2003, I lost one of my cousin sisters. Mm-hmm. She was my eldest cousin sister, my aunt's daughter. And she basically died mysteriously. So nobody knew how it happened, although there was a lot of suspicions that this might have had her, in-laws had some role. But the family was so shocked that we couldn't pursue this legally at that particular time. Yeah. So I think that too was something in the back of my mind, that, I couldn't do much for my own sister at that time. So at least I could do something for somebody else in the society. So, yeah. So these things have had an impact. So I don't think I see activism and journalism connected in a way for me personally, although, there are people who say that journalism is a form of activism in a way. But personally, I think I differentiated it very much so as an activist and a journalist. And as I said, activism was just an accident. And gradually after the Priyadarshini Mattu and reservation campaign, I did one more thing. I realized that I didn't do much for my community. So I formed a group called Roots in Kashmir. So this was mm-hmm. basically a group of passionate young Kashmiri Pandits who were my age, or maybe older. And we used to campaign, we used to spread awareness, organize symposiums and seminars and exhibitions, often protests as well. And we did this for about, I think, from 2006, December, to about 2008 or 9. Around 2008 or 9, I decided that, if I had to pursue my career in journalism, I couldn't continue as an activist. So 2008 is when I started writing for the Times of India as a student of Delhi University. And that's when I decided, and I had a very emotional meeting and a parting with folks at Roots in Kashmir who didn't want me to go. But I told them that, time had come and I had to bid adieu. And finally, I decided that activism was thing of the past. I did my bit, whatever I could, with my friends. And now we need to pursue journalism. So I started writing for the Times of India. Then I wrote for an Australian publication as well, a few other publications while I was a student of Delhi University. I later went to St. Xavier's in Bombay. I pursued my journalism there. And finally, as I always wanted to do print journalism, I landed up at Sunday Indian Magazine. I started writing for them. That's when I interviewed Prime Minister Modi when he was the Chief Minister of Gujarat at that time. And I also interviewed the chief of Hizbul Mujahideen, the terror organization in Pakistan-occupied Kashmir. So in my journalism career, I think I was just about, 23 at that time, 22 or 23. And so that really, again, became my claim to fame as a journalist.
When you started interviewing big shot people, how did you get those opportunities? Because I believe 23 and you're still early on in your career, people don't give chances to young journalists. You have to earn it, and senior journalists. How did that happen?
So while I was doing my post-graduation, and I need to tell you this, because this is the only one academic claim to fame. Because so I went to post-graduation because my parents didn't expect that. They had in their mind that perhaps I'll just do my graduation and that's about it. But I went for post-graduation, and that was a last minute decision that I took, because perhaps I said, I should at least be a post-graduate. So I went to Bombay, to St. Xavier's, which is a great place to study and be. And I ended up being the student of the year. And I wasn't academically very strong there as well, to be very honest. But fortunately, they saw all corners, all sides, including my journalism, my passion, my way with things. And it isn't just academics that mattered there. So I became the student of the year, which was a surprise to me as well. And to my fellow students who were toppers in the class, that why didn't they get that? But anyways, so I think I got a lot of motivation out of that thing as well. And so you said, how did I end it up initially? So while I was in Delhi University, as luck would have it, I was invited for many events. So although I was young, and it's almost unthinkable that I am a student of Delhi University, but I was invited as chief guest to many events in Delhi University itself. So I think I was, I can't recollect if it was the Khalsa College or the SRCC, one of these two events where I was there. And there were a few ministers and somebody from the Sunday Indian magazine as well there, who had seen me. And after I did my post-graduation, although Times Now and others had reached out and they said that, you know, I should join, but somehow I was not inclined towards television. So I got a call from Sunday Indian and they said that, would you like to join us? And so I came to Delhi, back from Bombay, and I joined them. But it was a great opportunity for me, certainly. It was a great break. I got great money and I got great opportunity, a good designation as well. I joined them as a special correspondent in the beginning of my career. So I think later I realized, although, I mean, I did my best there in the 10 months or a year that I spent there, I realized that it was a very comfortable job for me. It was almost like a retirement job, because I felt that if I don't face any challenges, or if I don't travel, or if I just don't, you know, exert a little more or exhaust myself at the end of the day, then, you know, it would be all futile. And I was in my early 20s back then. So I had this early realization that this is the time that I can really go out there, travel, face challenges, etc. I think in the later half of 30s, etc., I'm not going to do that. And I didn't want to regret it later. So finally, I decided that maybe, even though I was not inclined to join television, that I should, in fact, give television an opportunity. So I reached out to Times Now. I reached out to Arnab at that time. And although Arnab really was really keen to get me on board, but they somehow had this apprehension about my activism past. And I had a huge, huge, not argument, but, you know, on and off debate with them about this for over 9 months, that whether, you know, I will be able to accommodate myself in Times Now or not, whether, you know, my activism will get in way of my journalism there. So I had to convince them that, you know, that's think of the past and they didn't need to worry about anything.
So their concern was that if you will remain neutral or become partial to one side.
That's right. Their concern was that, and especially about Kashmir, because I had come into prominence in the Kashmir debate. And I used to, particularly on Kashmir, join these 9 p.m. primetime debates very often, all across channels, from NDTV to Times Now to CNN. With Rajdi, Barkha, Nidhi, Arnab, all of them. So all of them knew me, but they had this apprehension. Finally, they were convinced and Arnab hired me. And I was there with them for 4 years. Again, wonderful, great opportunities.
Before we go ahead,
yeah,
I actually want to ask you, how neutral can you remain on a subject which is very emotional to you?
Again, there are two things. One is the wider question of neutrality. Whether a journalist today is neutral or not, I would say nobody's neutral.
Yeah, I'm a political layman or a journalism layman, right? And for me, everybody has a bias. When I read the newspaper, when I see the TV, I can see the bias. I can see that whenever they're talking about a subject, they've already decided who's right or wrong. And then they're doing a narration. And they're trying to influence the viewer.
Yeah.
I hardly see a neutral point of view.
Right, right. So, Nakul, I think you are right because over the years, I've also realized, because I've worked with multiple channels, multiple media organizations, I've interacted with all, you know, journalists from all backgrounds and ages and ideologies. And I say ideology because, you know, let's face it, the media in India or elsewhere is divided between right and left now. So I think if anybody tells you that I'm a neutral journalist and I don't have a bias, I think you should not trust them. I think you should not have faith in the kind of journalism that they're doing. I think mostly, maybe there's a rare somebody who is genuine, but I think media is certainly very much divided on issues. People are emotional, and it is unthinkable that any journalist will not have an opinion about a particular issue. One, yes, a journalist would be clever enough to hide that opinion, but I think everybody has an opinion almost on all issues. It just depends that whether he reflects that opinion on television or in newspaper or magazine or a website or not. So you asked me about neutrality on an emotional issue. There are two things. One, there are many times that on stories, I used to just recuse myself. I used to tell them that, you know, if there was a Kashmiri Pandit protest or if there was a story in regard to a Kashmiri Pandit, I used to tell them that I will not do it. And I am sure many editors at times now, many desk people will be witness to this fact. And there would be messages still on my phone where I would say that please send somebody else. And, you know, I won't be comfortable doing this. And this would be not the right call. It's not that I don't trust myself. It's that, you know, in the perception or the narrative of the people who would be witnessing that story, they won't be, you know, comfortable, or they won't trust me enough with that particular story. So I would recuse myself immediately. It is certainly on, particularly when you have faced a lot of discrimination or a lot of, you know, a hard life due to a political turmoil or violence, etc. It is certainly difficult. I won't say it is easy. It is certainly difficult, but it depends on the person, on the individual, on the journalist, how he or she takes it forward.
Got it. Now, let's talk about a very interesting thing you said. You said you interviewed the Hizbul chief in POK. How did that come about? And, you know, how was that experience?
So I didn't go to POK, but I did this on phone because, you know, I wasn't sure if I go to POK, if I'll come back alive. Yeah. So as a, you know, as a 22-year-old or 23-year-old back then, I arranged the number through some of my sources. And there is a story after this also, which I will tell you. But it was a great feeling because usually, you know, I tend to feel that, you know, terrorists should not be given face, you know, space in media. I am of the bent of mind that, you know, we should not interview terrorists. But, you know, Hizbul chief came out to me as a very different kind of figure. He was very well educated. He was somebody who had left his entire family in Kashmir and stayed in POK for almost 3 decades now. His own children are political science professors and somebody also working with the JNK Bank and others. So when I called him, he didn't know that I'm a Kashmiri. We spoke in English and Hindi. And mind you, he spoke fluent English. We spoke in English, Hindi, Urdu. And somehow, I don't know, usually what happens if two Kashmiris are chatting, you end up, you know, speaking some Kashmiri. So I think I did that mistake after 15, 20 minutes of conversation. And I said something in Kashmiri and he said, are you a Kashmiri? I said, yeah, I am a Kashmiri. And so then he started speaking in Kashmiri as well. So I think those 20, 25 minutes of interview was a good opportunity for me. And later, I think 3 months later, I got a call from the National Investigative Agency, NIA, saying that, you know, our officer, senior officer would like to meet you. So I didn't know what this was about. So I went in. Those days, I think their office used to be in Jasola, the headquarters. And I went there and a senior officer, I think the SSP rank, met me and said that, you know, we've got a conversation of you with the Hizbul chief. And so we would like to talk to you about it. So I said, yeah, sure. I mean, I would love to help you. whatever your questions are. So they just generally ask me about, you know, how things went and, you know, how did I get the number, how did I get, etc. I told them everything, but I didn't tell them how I got the number because I told them that, you know, for a journalist, a source is most important. So I'm not going to reveal my source. I can just tell you one thing, that either my source is a negative antisocial element across the border, or the source is somebody like you, an officer. So it is somebody like you. So he was shut at that moment, and he didn't pursue that question anymore. So I had that thing. Later, I realized that, you know, they added me as a witness in one of the terror hawala cases against Syed Salahuddin that was being run by the NIA.
Yeah. And did you publish that interview?
Yeah. I can send you the copy.
I would love to listen. I these guys are so interesting. It is very interesting to see what they're thinking, how they're thinking.
Absolutely. I think that was the purpose because, you know, I have been very vocal against both terrorists as well as separatists. Personally speaking, you know, anybody who stands for violence, who stands for, you know, who doesn't believe in the Constitution, is somebody who we should not engage with, who we should not give space, honestly. But I think there are a couple of figures that I was really intrigued by. And I just, for my own experience, wanted to, you know, chat with them and know, you know, what their personality really is. So one is Syed Salahuddin, and another fellow was Syed Ali Shah Gilani. I mean, I'm sure you would have seen him on television and on paper.
Yeah.
White bearded fellow from Kashmir in his 90s now.
He's the head of the separatist movement, right?
Yeah, so he's the chief of the Huriyat. And he's been in Kashmir since ages earlier. He was an MLA also more than 3 decades ago. But then he left mainstream politics and joined separatism. So I was at an India Today conclave in Taj Hotel in Delhi. And I was invited as a guest by the India Today. So for the Kashmir session. And the current Kerala governor, Arif Mohammed Khan, was one of the panelists. There was also Farooq Abdullah. And there was Syed Salahuddin. Syed Ali Shah Gilani. So three of them were speaking, and I was one of the, you know, guests in the audience. And there were diplomats from different countries. There were government representatives. There were opposition leaders. There was who's who in the audience. And while you know, the event ended, somehow I got a surprise, although I wasn't told about this. The moderator of the session, a very senior journalist called Manoj Joshi, he invited me. Somehow I felt that Arun Puri, the chief of India Today, had told him to invite me. And he invited me for the last comments and said that, would you like to say something or ask a question? So this was like an opportunity for me. So I lost it completely. And I, you know, I just hit out at Gilani saying that, you know, I know what ideology you come from, and you stand for gun culture and violence, and you haven't even stood by your own people, and your own people in Huriyat have been killed by the gun that you stand for. And I couldn't believe my eyes, and that debate, etc., event was being televised live on Aaj Tak and India Today elsewhere. The clip later went viral all across. The people in the audience started hooting Gilani on my whatever comments happened. So later I received threats, etc. Also, I remember being a little shaken. But I think in a few years from that moment, I think this was 2010 or 11.
Who was threatening you?
People close to Gilani, you know, saying that, you know, you need to mend your ways and be careful, and otherwise there would be consequences. And so I remember complaining to a Delhi police as well, and, you know, there wasn't much that happened. But anyways, so this happened, and later Gilani was put into house arrest for many months, and finally, after house arrest, he had come to Delhi. So I was working in Sunday Indian. I think this was in 2012 or 13. And I reached out to him for an interview. So after this entire episode, I had the, you know, the call to, in fact, go to his house in South Delhi in Malviya Nagar. And I met him there. And I interviewed him for my magazine. And it was, again, a good experience for me. Although, you know, I didn't stand for whatever he said in that particular interview. But yeah, this was another experience worth it while I was working with the print media.
Yeah, I think it's very tough to, And as a maybe a journalist is more tougher because you're not in a debate. You're trying to hear the person out, and if the views are totally completely opposite to yours, it's very difficult to stay quiet.
True that, true that. It is difficult, but you know, as a journalist, you need to focus more on your work instead of you know, what's right or what's wrong.
So, how was your shift from print to TV? How did that happen?
Yeah, again, as I said, the so-called retirement job that I had, I wasn't very comfortable. In fact, I was very comfortable. That's the reason I quit. And so finally, Times Now was convinced that I would be able to do justice. And again, I was a shy person even back then. And it was initially very difficult for me to face the camera. You know, live broadcasts were very difficult, but I think it was a smooth transition. It happened, you know, well. And I think the 4 years that I spent in Times Now would be the best of my career. You know, I would always remember that. Not only because, you know, I got to cover conflict, foreign policy, and internal security as much as I wanted, but because I Arnab gave a lot of opportunities, you know. Although I used to slog a lot, I had no time for my family, I had no time even sometimes for food. But you know, I did whatever I could, and those were the learning years, so I don't regret it. Many people, you know, regret working with Arnab many times, but I think it for me personally, since I got opportunities, so I had a great time. So, I mean, I worked as a foreign journalist in the sense that I used to travel abroad frequently. While I was at Times Now, I visited almost 15 countries, you know, from G20 summit to SAARC summit. G20 in Australia, SAARC in Nepal, the India EU summit in Belgium, to you know, many 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 others. I mean, even I remember one of the most memorable trips was to Israel and Palestine. The first ever head of state from India to visit Israel and Palestine was Pranab Mukherjee in 2015. So I was part of his delegation. And I think there were senior journalists. There were about 20 or 30 senior editors, 20 or 25, who were with him. And at that time, if you were part of the delegation, you had to travel with the president on the, you know, his own airplane. But we took a moral stand. I remember we took a moral stand and we said that, you know, we'll travel, but we'll travel privately. We won't travel with the president because just because, you know, we don't want to take any favors. So we'll cover everything, we'll report everything, but we will not take the flight. We will buy our own tickets, we'll stay in our own hotel, and we'll pay our own travel locally, but we will not take any privileges or etc. So although I remember them being very surprised at this, because they said never before has this happened, you know, at Rashtrapati Bhavan, but if you want to, it's great. So more than a moral stand, I think this worked in my favor because Israel and Palestine, as you know, there's a conflict raging there and it's not easy to travel. So if I was with a delegation, I had to go through all the security protocols. I couldn't independently go out and, you know, report or travel anywhere or meet people. I had to seek permission and I could only move out if the president wanted, you know, to move out. So I was only allowed along with the president delegation. So as an independent person there, I could go anywhere. So I remember frequently, you know, traveling from Jerusalem to Ramallah in Palestine. This was just about 40 minutes distance. And I used to frequently travel. I mean, I remember one day before, because I had arrived 2 days in advance. So one day before president finally arriving, I think I got busy because I was recording, etc. So I came out late. And somebody from the Indian mission in Palestine got to know, and they called me, and they almost, you know, screamed at me that, you know, we don't dare travel between Palestine and Israel at night, and you know, at daytime, and you're doing it at night at midnight. So I mean, it was fun. It was great for me personally. And the most astonishing or most surprising aspect was that for 2 days I did a lot of recce. I, you know, I visited a lot of places in Ramallah, in Jerusalem. I traveled a lot, and I also went to the president's house in Ramallah. So usually you don't get, you know, big time interviews. You had to plan this months or maybe weeks in advance. But I just left a small note with the president's media, you know, advisor. And I told him that, you know, I would be really, you know, honored if the president, Mahmoud Abbas, gives me an opportunity for an interview. So I just left it there and I forgot about it because, you know, usually it does not happen. It is unthinkable that it will happen. And my video journalist, a very nice fellow called Sachin Rawat, he said, boss, you know, mil gaya to bahut accha ho jayega, lekin lagta to nahi milega, chalo koi baat nahi, at least koshish to ki humne. But so next day in the evening when the president arrived and the everything is happening, so usually I'm obviously presidents, I have to cover all the president's events. But for a couple of events, I wasn't there because I got a call from the president's, you know, office in Ramallah saying that, you know, we've been calling you and your number is unreachable. The president wants to give you the interview. And I said, okay, when? He said, you know, anytime, you just come. I was like, wow. I said, I just have one camera and, you know, is it okay? They said, oh, that's okay. We will arrange the, you know, the Doordarshan of Palestine, which was the Palestine television. And we'll ask them to arrange more cameras, etc. for you. So I did that interview with Mahmoud Abbas. And that was a great experience in itself. But also for me, because I was the youngest journalist in the delegation. And there were senior editors who were puzzled and, you know, perplexed that how did this 24-year-old fellow ended up doing this interview with the president. So I think that was a great opportunity. And I remember after the interview, president shook my hand. And he said that, you know, I look forward to meet you in India someday. And I said, yeah, God willing, we'll meet. And then he asked me, will it be okay if we click a photograph? I said, yes, of course, it will be my honor. So it was a great, great experience. So he gave me an autographed photograph of him, which I now keep in my study.
Wow. But what kind of environment is there in these kind of conferences? Is everybody tensed about what's going to happen or it's a party time, you know?
See, usually there are two or three aspects to your question that I will answer. One, I would divide these events or conferences or visits into two segments. One is the normal course that happens like a multilateral summit like G20 or SAARC, for instance, or BRICS, where, you know, we know that it is going to be a two-day or a three-day affair. The prime minister or the president is going to speak on the second day on this time slot. We will not be allowed inside. We will have a separate media enclosure. We'll have to do this. We'll have to do that. So everything is almost planned or decided. We know the drill, basically. But if it is a conflict area, if it is a place like Palestine or Israel, or for instance, even South Korea, North Korea is unthinkable. I think there are different protocols to be kept in mind. The journalists who travel have to think about the security aspect, have to think about what all is advisable, where you can travel, etc. But I think much before this, I'll tell you about a very brief experience that I had. My first foreign visit, or perhaps not foreign visit, but foreign professional visit, was to Iraq. In 2014, when the ISIS really became the famous terror organization all across the globe. And if you remember, Nakul, some Indians were kidnapped by the ISIS in 2014 in Mosul and Tikrit in Iraq.
These were the guys who were drilling for oil.
They were working in different aspects. I mean, one, there were two groups of Indians who were kidnapped. One group was construction workers and oil drillers who were mainly from Punjab, mainly Sardars and Sikh. And the other group was of nurses that happened in Tikrit. So I had to go there, but the Iraq embassy in New Delhi was not giving visas. And was saying that, you know, we can't do that because of the security, you know, thing development there. And the Indian government has refused us to grant visas to Indian nationals. So we can't go ahead. So it was a mighty task for me. So my company gave me an offer that, you know, either you go to Turkey or you go to Jordan. And from there in the Iraq mission, you apply a visa and finally visit Iraq. So although I was very keen to go to Turkey, my friends advised me that go to Jordan, and Jordan is a place where you can finally get the visa. And there is a Jordan-Iraq border, which is very volatile. So maybe you can report from there as well. So I finally landed in Amman in Jordan, and I went to the Iraqi embassy, and it was a mighty task. It took a week for me to, jaise kehte na, beg, borrow, steal. So I had to beg almost before them, that because they were not convinced that, you know, why I was in Jordan, and, you know, why didn't I not apply in Delhi and instead here? So I had to tell them a long story that, you know, I was just visiting Jordan for some travel, and my office just wants me to go from here. So kindly, you know, do this. So I had to give them a written this thing that if something happens to me in Iraq, in violence or terrorism or whatever, I will be responsible. And, you know, I can't hold the Iraq government or whatever responsible for it. So although I got an opportunity to visit Iraq-Jordan border, which was like about 400 kilometers away. And it was great because Al Jazeera was the only channel reporting from there. And it was desert for hundreds of kilometers. So I reported from there. I finally went to Iraq. And to be very honest, I was very scared. Usually, if you speak to a war journalist or a conflict reporter, they will, you know, praise themselves a lot or give you anecdotes about their travel, etc. But honestly, I was very scared. One, also because, you know, I was almost alone. I had just one video journalist who couldn't speak much of English. And this was my first foreign assignment. So, you know, I spent another, I think, week or 2 weeks in Iraq, in Baghdad. And that's how, you know, it all started. And that was the first big assignment that I had got from Times Now. And this will remain a memory forever. And finally, I tracked the, you know, Indians very closely. Fortunately, the nurses were released from there within the 2 days of my arrival. But the six gentlemen who were all, I think 40 of them who were kidnapped, couldn't be traced. And years later, I think this was just about, I think, 2 or 3 years back, the government of India declared them dead.
So 4 years in Times Now.
Yeah.
And then?
So 4 years in Times Now. And although I was at that time very much at the peak of my TV career, and Arnab offered me that, you know, he wants to start his own initiative, and, you know,
you joined Republic.
I should start, you know, I should be, start this channel with him. So initially I was in two minds that, you know, should I or shouldn't I, but one reason that really triggered and, you know, I decided immediately was the fact that he gave me a lot of opportunities. So, you know, you feel not exactly indebted, but yes, indebted, that, you know, this guy has gone all the way for me. As a young journalist, he has given me a lot of opportunities. So why not at least give him back? And, you know, if he's starting something new, trust him and go about it. And I had the confidence that, you know, Arnab knew the business. So I wouldn't say Arnab knows only journalism. He knew the business. He knows the marketing and sales, how to do it. So that's how Times Now has been successful. So I joined Republic with him. I joined as an associate editor there, one of the founding members of Republic team. I hired, in fact, the initial team that was, you know, that started the entire channel finally, from the desk to the reporters to the bureau chiefs. I got them on board. So I spent 2 years in Republic, and again, I used to Kashmir. I covered very, very closely in Republic days. I traveled to Kashmir very frequently. I covered several terror attacks in Kashmir as well as in Jammu. I remember also traveling to China once for the BRICS summit in Xinjiang, and that's about it. I mean, Republic days were good learning experience again for me. But I think by the end of 2018, I realized that, you know, I need a break because 6 years in television is huge. And especially if you're working with Arnab Goswami, it's massive. So I think I desperately needed a break. And I also needed time to reflect and ponder how I need to really pursue this much ahead. So while I quit Republic, I immediately got an offer from a business channel called BTVI. And which was earlier Bloomberg. And they wanted me to do my own show on strategic affairs and internal security and conflict, which I did for 6 months there as well. So that's when I finally took a break from television last year.
Okay. And what are you up to these days?
Well, you know, I've been an independent journalist since September 2019. By the end of 2019, I got an invitation from the U.S. State Department for an exchange fellowship. And in January and Feb, for a month, I was in U.S. I spent time with the U.S. State Department and different other organizations, etc., particularly in Washington, D.C. and Iowa. So I followed the elections very closely. I was fortunate enough to participate in the initial events of Joe Biden, Andrew Yang, and a few others in Iowa. And so that was a great experience for me. And since then, I've been writing for different publications, appearing on television as well sometimes, and just doing whatever I want to. So I've been an independent journalist, although I wouldn't say that I've quit TV forever, but I'm still, trying to understand how TV or the digital market is going to, move ahead, because there is a lot of churning that's happening, Nakul, and a lot of changes that will happen, not just in India, but globally.
Yeah, the business of media has changed overall, right? It's not making money.
I would say that, I said this to somebody very recently, that I wouldn't call or write TV's obituary yet, but newspapers are dying. So newspapers are almost at that stage that they are on the ventilator. So newspapers will last another 5 years maximum, or about 8 years. But in 5 years, I think newspapers will be non-existent, because even today, if you see, newspapers are almost digital, all of them. And newspapers, maybe for the old world charm, my father, buys the Times of India and Dainik Jagran every day since last many years. But for last at least 5 to 6 years, I don't remember, going through the newspaper. I get all my content from Twitter, from, other apps and websites.
I'm on the same league as your father.
Yes,
I'm old school, so I need my morning routine is the newspaper. If I don't read the newspaper, and while I'm on Twitter and I read all the apps and everything, but my the daily routine is so fixed that I need the newspaper.
Which is true. Which is for many people, I think, but I still feel that slowly. Even before coronavirus pandemic, that people have been shifting more from newspapers to the digital field. And corona has triggered this huge push for the newspapers as well, because I know for a fact that newspapers are not making money at all. So, and their revenues are decreasing, and even the copies that they are printing now are decreasing every other week. So I think, as I said, newspapers are, going to last just a few years.
Yeah, but I do feel, and again, this may be my bias towards print, that if you read an article in the newspaper, is more neutral to maybe a story on digital and maybe especially on television.
I agree. If you talk about a newspaper on a television, any day newspaper would have, in fact, more balanced coverage.
Yeah, fact-based coverage rather than opinion-based coverage. Yeah,
I wouldn't call all newspapers, again, neutral, etc. But I still feel newspapers justify their coverage. They do comprehensive coverage. They try to at least give all sides some kind of perspective and space in the newspaper. But, you'll be astonished, Nakul. Since the year 2016, mainly, even before for that matter, I haven't watched television since 2016. I have been working in television, but I have stopped watching television. I do get my content from, Netflix or Prime sometimes. But otherwise, particularly news channels on television, I've stopped watching since 2016. And I'm pretty sure that even people have been slowly doing that and slowly turning into mobile phones as well. And more so, this has happened in the COVID-19 pandemic, that content has shifted more to your mobile screens, and people, both their digital video and text has drastically shifted towards mobile. And I'm pretty sure that even news channels are recalibrating and re-strategizing as to how to focus more on mobile phones, because there are apps like the JioTV, etc., where you get everything on your mobile phone. So why bother about a television? So people usually, what they do, many of my friends also do that, they get all their content, news, etc., from their mobile, and they usually keep their television sets only for Netflix and OTT platforms.
So I agree on some news channels. I have not watched for a while, maybe 5-6 years, news channels on TV, and especially the debates. Debates are disgusting. You cannot, so everybody is just trying to shout their opinion and nobody is willing to listen. So those are just weird.
I'm glad that you said this instead of me, because I didn't want to do the dirty job.
No, but people love it.
I say this always, that while many people criticize this, my father, for example, I hope he's not listening. He used to criticize Arnab a lot. And he used to criticize Times Now and Republic a lot, particularly for many of their debates on primetime, and say that, has he lost it? Why is he screaming so much? And, this is not done. This is not how graceful debates happen. You need to give everyone opportunity, and you can't just scream and, And then in a couple of days, he's again watching the same channel and the same debate.
And I know so many people who love those debates, but they don't add value to anybody, right? It's just 10 people giving their own opinion and nobody's listening.
Problem, Nakul, is that the Indian masses and the Indian audience loves tamasha. They love chaos. They love a lot of screaming, shouting, etc. Usme bahut maza aata hai.
Yeah, and if that sells, then that's it.
Yeah, so I always say this, that, rhetoric sells in India. So this rhetoric, jitna ye zyada hota hai, utna, I wouldn't like to, speak in detail, but recently we saw what happened in the Sushant Rajput case. Media turned into a court, and things really happened as per media's whims and fancies.
But that happens on actually every aspect now,
Every aspect, yes.
It's not true facts which are coming out. It's a WhatsApp university which is creating fictional news.
It was only happening in corruption cases. Like I remember the Railgate, the Coalgate, or the CWG scam, etc. That used to happen. And Augusta Westland scam. So there used to be a lot of screaming, a lot of outrage over it, which is still to an extent understandable, because people are upset. People want transparency and accountability, etc. But now that, it has become a fish market where only people who can scream or fight or jostle get more space, etc. It is funny. It is hilarious. I think this is one of the major reasons that I couldn't accommodate myself. And, I decided that at least I need a break from this and need to calm down. I think at least more than me, people on the prime time need to calm down. But I think I just said that, ye mujhse nahi hone wala. And at least, I can't scream. So as much as I try, but that's not in my nature.
Nee, meko to ye bhi lagta hai, the people they invite for the debate show, they're only looking for people who can give a very extreme opinion.
Absolutely.
And just shout about it. They don't get, for example, they don't want a balanced view. They don't want somebody somebody as a viewer who's a neutral party. Now, I consider myself a very neutral guy politically, right? I voted for Congress. I voted for BJP. I like some things about BJP. I like some things about the opposition. But in India, either you are left or right. You can't be neutral. Why can't you be neutral?
I will just correct you a little, although I completely agree with you, Nakul. The problem here is not just about India. India, yes, you know, we have happening this huge churning is happening politically and on media as well, particularly in media, significantly in media, because media is still at a very nascent stage here. We are still learning. We are still accommodating. We are still evolving. But if you closely monitor United States, Nakul, it is worse than India. So, हमें तो अपना dirt दिखता है या you know cesspool दिखता है. But US में जो आप अभी देखोगे, if you see the kind of divide that is happening post the elections also, when Joe Biden and Trump are you know at loggerheads, Trump is not ready to concede and Joe Biden has declared himself a winner, obviously. So the kind of messages that I track on Twitter, on the television screens in you know, US also, that media is again divided there. The media is divided between right and the left. You saw the screaming matches that happened between Trump and CNN, particularly with Trump and New York Times and Washington Post. And I think it is much more divided there as well. And the same thing is reflective here. I remember, you know, there was, I think some website had done, a foreign website or an Indian website had done a television, a digital piece on Republic and said that Republic TV is Fox TV on steroids. So you know, we learn and we try to ape the West. So that's what is happening in the media as well. There's a strong, huge divide that has evolved in United States, which somehow not many of us maybe bother to observe. But the same reflection is happening on a much worse scale here, because हम हर चीज की जो है ना हद पार कर देते हैं. तो वो ही हो रहा है वहाँ यहाँ पर भी. इसको टाइम लगेगा सुधरने में. This will take a lot of time to you know change, mature, evolve. Eventually it will happen. But अभी unfortunately वही है कि नहीं तो आप जो है वक्त के लाए जाते हैं, नहीं तो आप किसी आपटार्ड हैं या तो कुछ और है. क्योंकि मुझे तो हर तरह की ये गाली पड़ती है. इफ आई यू नो ट्वीट समथिंग यू नो विच गोज पॉजिटिव टुवर्ड्स नरेंद्र मोदी और बीजेपी, आई एम टर्म्ड एज अ संगी. इफ आई समथिंग अबाउट अरविंद केजरीवाल, आई एम एन अपटार्ड. और इफ यू नो इट इज द कांग्रेस, देन आई एम अ पप्पू सपोर्टर एक्सेट्रा. सो और यू नो कोंगी दलाल. सो दिस कीप्स हैपनिंग अनफॉर्चुनेटली. एंड मीडिया, because of what media has become and done to itself, is you know learning its lessons, unfortunately. But Nakul, in the Indian media context, what I will tell you is that while you know Arnab is criticized, maybe some, you know sometimes for the right reasons, there is the other side also. And the other side is years ago when I used to monitor media. And we didn't know, you know, we used to consider NDTV and others like very neutral and gospel truth givers. And I remember the Radia Gate. You know, what was Radia Gate? A particular journalist who used to speak between corporate lobbyists and politicians, trying to, you know, fix cabinet berths. I mean, this is unthinkable. And again, during that time, there was no action taken. There was no, you know, investigative agencies took no action at all. And everything happened and everything was okay, hunky-dory again. And I remember, I didn't mention this in the conversation, Nakul. While I was in my first debate on NDTV, this was March 2006 with Nidhi Razdan. And I told you that Vinod Mehta was with me. And while walking out of the office, Vinod Mehta was very generous. He was old, frail at that time as well. And he said that, you look, young man, if you need any help, anytime you know, reach out to me, I'll help you because, you know, you're taking on the powerful and don't worry about anything. So I was really happy, excited, etc. Just a few years later, the Radia Gate happened. Vinod Mehta was one of the two magazines that dared to publish about journalists and fixers on the front page of the Outlook magazine, of which he was the editor-in-chief. I don't know if you know this or came across at that time. NDTV immediately banned Vinod Mehta from appearing on the channel. Now imagine, because of the Radia Gate coverage, Vinod Mehta was banned. And similar thing happened with me as well. On Kashmir, because I was very much against separatists and terrorists, and Barkha and others knew very well what my views are going to be, they gagged me as well. They banned me from the television. I used to appear regularly on their prime time, on their, Be the People and The Big Fight and other programs. And immediately one fine day, a friend who was very close to them, he informed me that, they have taken a call and they've banned you and they won't further invite you ever. So this used to happen. And, this is unfortunate. While there are these huge editors and journalists who claim to have millions of followers on Twitter, in reality, they have been very biased and they have been unfair to their own tribe. So Vinod Mehta, who's known for his journalistic careers of decades, was silenced because he tried to unearth this corruption and this unethical practice of lobbyism that journalists were involved in. So
No, it's sad. Moving on to more, now we are sitting in 2020, COVID has happened, and I keep hearing that now it's time for public journalism. Everybody is a reporter,
right?
Everybody's got a smartphone, and it's not anymore a journalist's job to be a journalist. What's your take on it?
That's right. I think things are changing. As I said, media is also evolving. Technology has been changing drastically. I remember in the early days when Orkut used to be there and there was no Facebook or Twitter, there used to be a particular website, I think Mary something, and that used to invite people for public journalism. So anybody could log in and write articles or upload their videos, etc. At that time, and I at that time was very furious because I said that I'm a journalist or I want to become a journalist, then why are they asking anybody to upload these videos as a journalist? But when time changed, people evolved, media evolved, and technology also evolved. Now you rightly said that everybody has the power to express themselves, expose anything wrong that's happening in the society, etc., against the government, against the administration, against the politicians or the bureaucrats, etc. And that's been happening. There's more transparency because of social media. There's more transparency because of public activism or public journalism, as you call it. So I think this is good. This is fair. But if I see this in context of social media as well, particularly Twitter and Facebook, there's a lot of negative side as well. There's a lot of abuse. There's a lot of propaganda and there are a lot of bots in this entire exercise. So I think while social media has been great for all of us, has been wonderful for all of us, but there is a negative side to it where Twitter and Facebook have failed to in fact bring in this kind of a public policy where they can in fact reduce such kind of hate content and reduce it drastically. So those kinds of features, although now they say that they're trying to bring in those features. Often we see Trump's tweet being blocked. But I think that's not it. There's a lot of hate content, violent content, etc. that goes on Twitter and Facebook, and things need to be done. And
no, I remember, I think 1.5 years ago, I started unfollowing anybody on Twitter who was politically driven. Because then, and if you are following them and then your tweet wall is always about retweets of one side of the story only, right? And then because you are on Twitter all the time, then your opinion becomes so one-sided, right? Because if you're following somebody who say a Bhakt, right, and then he would be retweeting everybody who's for that, and then you think, oh, this is the general sense of the market, right? Everybody's talking only about this, which is not true, because you have actually not looking at the other tweets which are not on your wall, and it's so biased.
Absolutely, I agree with you. I mean, as an individual, as you said, you started unfollowing. If I give you an example, not just Twitter, in my real life, initial days when I was just new to television, I was asked to cover everything. So I used to cover BJP, I used to cover Congress, I used to cover later when Aam Aadmi Party was formed, I used to cover them. So I somehow became very bitter with the political reportage. And few years I decided, I think it was somewhere in 2014 or 15, that, you know, I can't cover politics. Because the kind of discourse that we had reduced this into, the kind of, you know, retweet matches or the abuse contests on tweets, on Facebook, etc., had happened, I decided to move away completely from political reportage. So even now, when I try to, if I interview politicians, it's mostly not on the political context. It's mostly on internal affairs, etc., etc. And you're right. I have myself tried to reduce, political, following political, handles as much as possible. But unfortunately, as a journalist, I have to keep a track of things. So I can't follow it completely on Twitter. But, such is life. And, you know, I just wanted to touch another aspect. And that aspect has been, even though we have a free media in India, look at what's been happening in China. The kind of propaganda wars that's been happening, etc. And they use media as a propaganda tool, as an information warfare. And if I see this from the Indian government perspective, I think Indian government to a great extent has failed in messaging. Now, I won't encourage the government as a journalist to buy media or buy media silence or encourage media to, you know, tweet or report everything in government's favor. But I think we need to learn as well as unlearn a lot from what China has been doing in respect to propaganda. Because obviously we know there's no free media in China. All the media organizations report to the communist regime. There are categorization of media organization, and the Chinese military and the Chinese communist regime track everything that they do. And there's a diktat that's given. There's a line that has to be taken every time. We are comparatively a free, media. But still, on an overall messaging, I feel the government has failed to a great extent. There's no communication strategy that the government really has. We, as somebody who covers strategic affairs very closely, internal affairs very closely, I saw this happening after the Balakot attack that happened. I saw this happening also after Article 370 and 35 were abrogated. I'm sorry, I went a little technical. It is a little problematic, and we will suffer more if the government's messaging strategy is not right.
So tell me one more thing. Now, since now for 3 decades, we have been on a advertising based revenue model for media.
Right.
And clearly that's not working for print now. And I've seen a couple of, so I think a lot of new digital age startups have started some subscription based, news service.
Right.
Where you pay per article and a freemium model kind of thing. Do you think that would work? And we will shift to paid news versus free news with advertisement. Will that work?
It's very difficult, but it has to work eventually. Because once that is the model that is followed by, you know, one and all, eventually it will become a reality. In the Indian market context, I think, as I said, the media is still, you know, evolving. There's a lot of churning happening. So you have to see, I freelance, as a contributing editor with an organization called Airshot. So Airshot came up with a new concept in India on the models of, you know, the NPR in US, the National Public Radio. They did not come out with a radio station yet, but they have come out with a website and an app, which is completely audio-driven news and audio-driven content, which is still something that the Indians are not ready for. But I think they are trying to develop a revenue model around it. They have deals with, you know, organizations like Spotify and other, such media organizations. And I see a lot of journalists, particularly in COVID, who are turning to podcasts, who are turning to, you know, such out-of-the-box initiatives. And I think these are here to stay. Although, as I said, the Indian market is still not ready to accommodate this. We are still As you said, you love your morning newspaper still. There are still many people who do that. Still, people enjoy the bickering and the fighting matches that happen on prime time. So I think the Indian audience and the Indian media both will take time to eventually, you know, be progressive, be accommodative, be understanding, evolve. But it will take time. What will also happen is that the kind of television channels that we see today will completely turn digital. I think that just like OTT platforms, we'll have digital televisions. I know one for sure, which is happening, I think, early part of next year. An English channel that is coming up will be launched next year, which will be completely digital. It will work like a news channel completely, but it will not be available on television. It will only be available on 24/7 on the digital medium. So I think things are evolving, things are changing, revenue models are changing, and people are getting, you know, decreasing revenue. Channels like Aaj Tak, even Republic for that matter, that have been booming because of the kind of revenue that has come. I think in the COVID months, this particular year, a lot has changed. And I think they will recalibrate their positions. Unfortunately, a lot of journalists have been fired. A lot of media organizations are shutting down. Only today I came to know that the Huffington Post India has shut down. And today was their last day. So I think on a global scale, things are changing. But digital, I think, has arrived, is here to stay. Just like we saw a transition from Orkut to Facebook to Twitter, I think on the news medium as well, a lot is going to change in the coming months and years.
So my last point was on the recent thing which happened with Arnab and the Maharashtra government, right? What are your views? Is politics going to, you know, and I'm not saying Arnab is wrong, right in any way, or I'm not defending him. But the fact is that it's a politically motivated decision to get him there, whatever that was done. Now, that means that a journalist, if a powerful journalist like Arnab can be taken up by a state government, then nobody in India is safe.
Exactly. I echo your views, Nakul, because, you know, I've been a journalist for more than a decade now, and a TV journalist for 7 years. So I have seen, this kind of threats and intimidation that happen from politicians particularly. I faced defamation from, you know, political parties, both the Congress and the BJP, and from the PDP in Jammu and Kashmir. So I know how these theatrics really work. But unfortunately, again, not going into the merits, whether, you know, Arnab's journalism is right or wrong, whether we agree with his ideology or the way he does things. But what the government in Maharashtra did was absolutely wrong. I think this was a political vendetta. I think this conveys a very wrong message and a wrong signal. Unfortunately, because of the divided media, we didn't see many channels or editors or journalist bodies really coming out in favor of Arnab. Again, I don't think that Arnab also felt that anybody would support him. I think that only makes him stronger because, you know, he's different and he tries to appear different and alone in the battle. But I think he will and is emerging only more stronger because of the kind of political vendetta, and for a week he was imprisoned. So the politicians thought that they will convey a message to Arnab. Because for many years, the Congress party has been very upset, particularly after Rahul Gandhi's interview with Arnab that turned into a disaster. And later years, also many corruption scandals, and particularly after BJP came to power, Arnab again tried to focus only on the Congress party and the UPA. So I think they were upset, they were furious, and they decided to do this as a response, as a collective response of the three political parties that are in power in Maharashtra. But I think this was absolutely wrong. What happened with Arnab could happen with me or anybody else from any other ideology. And I think that collectively, journalists should have spoken out against it. And for that matter, if this happens tomorrow with any other journalist, I mean, you as a political party or a government feel uncomfortable with the way an editor or a journalist is speaking out or reacting, well, hello. I mean, journalists are meant to make you uncomfortable. Journalists meant to shake you. But I think it sent a very wrong precedent. And I think these political parties are going to regret this.
No, and not so. My problem is not with them doing it. My problem is now, will it give an open invitation for a BJP to do it in their state governments?
I think so.
Which will only go worse, right? For the common person who's saying, hey, if a powerful person like Arnab can go to jail on fictitious charges, then nobody's safe.
See, that is why I said that this is a political vendetta. And this is a exercise to convey a message. So they felt that they will convey this message. And ultimately, you know, if you see, Nakul, if you have observed this particular instance, this is basically a battle between BJP and the Shiv Sena Congress in NCP. This is a battle between central government and the Maharashtra government. And in the process, I think they have set a wrong precedent. Because this precedent will now motivate other governments, be it BJP, be it other regional political parties or etc., who will come out not just against journalists and shoot the messenger, but they will also come out against the common people. I mean, this has been happening before as well, but now it will gain prominence every time somebody on the social media or on television or elsewhere will speak out against a particular politician. Immediately there will be a reaction to it, and especially if that politician is in power. So I think this is wrong. This was absolutely unnecessary exercise. And unfortunately, we will see consequences of this continuing in months and years.
Yeah, it's going to be tough living in India. Well, for example, my opinion on Indian police is anyways, like, if I have to give them rating, I'll give them 1 out of 10 or minus 1 if I can, right? Because they are unfair. Yeah, they don't listen to any, and I have had my enough interaction with them because of the kind of business I am in, right? I deal with secondhand phones, so there could be stolen phones, there could be this, that. And I've dealt with them, and what motivates them, I don't know. You know, their motivation is to trouble citizens. They know who's right, they know who's wrong, but they know this person can be troubled, so let me trouble them.
True, I think I tend to agree with you, although I would say that all the entire police force is...
You can never generalize, right?
You can never generalize. But I think I feel what you are saying. This also stems from the fact, Nakul, that the police force in India, or for that matter, any organization or bureaucracy, there is a lack of professionalism, you know, in other organizations, in other fields also. If there is a lack of professionalism and there is this, you know, machoism that is within you, then there are problems that happen. And that is why, like, a common person like you or me or anybody else tends to feel uncomfortable. Tabhi, you know, there are these small instances when there an accident happens, people fear taking, help or, help the people who undergo accident, because, you know, police is going to harass them. Police is going to do this. Police is going to do that. We don't file FIRs. We don't file complaints because we know that either nothing will happen or the police would be lackadaisical and they will do nothing. So I think you are right that, you know, there is an overall, a shakeup that is required. There is a lot of churning that is required, not just within the police force, but all across the bureaucracy, all across, these things, because they need to be professional. They are public servants. And, you know, if the public is unhappy, if the people are not being cared about, then I think the problem begins. So I think there are massive reforms that are required in the police force. And I think to begin with the laws also, because there are many British laws that are still existent. And there are...
No, I am so in sync with you. The police force needs such a massive overhaul, right? In terms of law, in terms of training, in terms of even their salaries, right? They need to be paid more. They just so yeah. I've had so many experiences. Now I know so much law because I had to read so much. And even with all that knowledge with me, it's hey, do I want to waste time with those guys arguing for 3 4 hours because they don't have logic? They will keep creating new sections, and even if I have replies to these sections, they will create new things which will not make sense in the court of law. And but you know, they have all the time in the world and you
Basically,
don't.
just a technique to harass. This is a harassment technique. This is a fit case of harassment that happens very frequently in India. I mean, we know how even people who are connected and powerful utilize the police force against the common people, how the police force unfortunately are used to intimidate and threaten. And these such tactics have been used, unfortunately, time and again. And there's no transparency. I mean, if you speak up against a police officer, against corruption or for that matter some favoritism that has been happening, in 98 of 100 cases you will see no action being taken.
Aditya, this was so amazing. I just had a great time talking with you, and thanks a lot for spending so much time with us, you know. And I got to learn so much about the media industry and journalism, and your journey is so amazing. And I'm looking forward to, you know, keep listening to you and hearing about you and, you know, doing great things. And best of luck to you, man.
Thank you so much, Nakul. It was an honor, really, because although you interviewed me, I hope I get an opportunity to interview you as well, because you've been creating waves for last several years as well, and I'm glad that we connected and we got to speak on Upgrade with Nakul. Thank you.
So guys, Upgrade what ya? You were listening to Upgrade with Nakul, a production of the Forging.in. Don't forget to like and subscribe.